Are you feeling burnt out, overwhelmed? Like you're just an Uber driver to your kids' endless appointments? Do you wonder, is this all there is? Stop driving around and try something different. Book in with Body and Mind Online for expert speech therapy, occupational therapy, psychologist and counselors via telehealth. I founded Body and Mind Online 5 years ago, and it has since been one of the most inclusive therapy centers in the country. This podcast is my passion project. But I've realized that by not openly recommending Body and Mind Online, I'm leaving many of you to navigate the daunting task of finding the right providers on your own. Stop the struggle and get the support that you and your family deserve. Visit adhdmums.com.au and visit the services page to take the first step forward towards a balanced life with Body and Mind Online. Welcome to the ADHD Mums Podcast, a safe place for everyday Australian mums to discuss their struggles with ADHD, motherhood, and life. Hello, and welcome to another episode of ADHD Mums. Do you have an antagonist? And I'm going to talk about antagonists in terms of boys, just because I have two antagonist boys, but it can be in both genders or gender diverse. It can present in any way. I'm just using boys because that's my own experience. One of the key aspects with ADHD, and a lot of us talk about roller coaster lives that we've lived or risks that we've taken, a lot of people with ADHD engage in quite risky activities in drugs, alcohol. They might have interests that are quite dopamine seeking, for example, surfing, skating, bike riding as well. Social media has a massive dopamine hit. You will find ADHD people in a lot of dopamine rich environments. Podcasting, I'll say it, is one of those as well. Reason being, and I'm not going to get too far into it because I think a lot of people have a understanding that people with ADHD need more dopamine and they're dopamine deficient. But a point to make before we start talking about children is that it can be very difficult for adults to get reward from ordinary tasks. So for example, we talk about this on this podcast all the time, how hard it is to wash the dishes, fold the clothes, do the lunches, how difficult those tasks are. And as mothers and wives, we often get more and more and more of them. It's not just one load of washing now, it's four. It's five people's bags. The sheer quantity increases, which adds to our cumulative load. And the cumulative load, sadly, is the things that generally people find that they don't enjoy or they don't get a lot of dopamine from. So in turn with our children, we are bringing up children that possibly have ADHD as well and are going to have the same challenges. So asking them to put their bag away, asking them to do their homework, talking to them about doing something that they think is boring is going to feel really difficult for them. And when we say, why can't you just do it? It's because their reward center in their brain, it's boring and they don't get anything from it. And they want to do things where they get dopamine. And this is for a child who's undiagnosed, who you think may have ADHD, or a diagnosed and medicated child. I'm not a parenting expert. However, I'm a mum with lived experience who's a neuroscientist, and I really specialize in self-care for mums. But I did want to touch on the antagonist child because every time I put anything on Instagram about my two boys, I just get so many questions. And I wanted to do a quick episode about what works for me, which may not work for you. Every ADHD child is different, and I've tried a lot of different things, but I do have a technique that I would love to share. Whether it works for you or not, I don't know. And whether you agree with it or not, I don't know. But this is what works for us and has been working for us for the past probably 18 months. So for those of you who are quite new to this podcast, I have three children. I have an older daughter and I have two younger boys, and they are all born within 3 years of each other, which was a very ADHD thing to do. Now, the two boys are an interesting mix. My daughter is a heavily internalizing, camouflaged presentation, and my youngest son actually has that presentation very similar as well. So the internalized ADHD presentation, and it can be for autism and other presentations as well. Internalizing means that they internalize their emotions. They may be incredibly unhappy, but they will suck it up. They will smile and they will not say anything until they get home, and they will hold it all in. They're the kids that teachers will say there's nothing going on with them. They're 100% fine. And sometimes the parent can get gaslit a little bit where you start to wonder, oh, is it me? why are they fine everywhere else? And then we have on the other end an externalizer. And we have those children who are more obvious and they're picked up a little bit more by teachers because the teachers, I hate saying exasperated, but they may be exasperated with them and they are disruptive. They will disrupt a classroom. They will do things on purpose and they may possibly hit other kids. They can be a bit sensory seeking and the hitting doesn't necessarily have to be a malicious thing. It can just be a constant tapping, poking of others. And constantly wanting something to happen because they have a lot of boredom. And a lot of ADHD kids have a lot of boredom. But what you do with that boredom is obviously based on your own individual characteristics. So I'll run you through what an antagonist child looks like in my home. And you can see whether this is something that works for you, that you can relate to. Generally, it is boys, but it can absolutely be girls. And of course, gender diverse, it can affect as well. But I do see it a lot more in boys. So I have an antagonist. Gus has just turned 7 and he has always been, for me, a very challenging personality. He's very roller coastery because at the same time, I get the most incredible hugs, kisses, and he absolutely worships the ground I work on. Like my husband can't even get near me without Gus being in the middle of us. We had a pool guy came the other day and I was talking to the pool guy. He was new about what we needed to get done in the new pool. And I could actually feel these eyes, like it was creepy feeling. And the pool guy actually noticed as well. And he started looking around and all we could see was Gus' eyes laser beamed at him with this look of like, what's he doing? Is he a threat to my mother? What should I do? And honestly, like he was terrifying to look at. I thought, and the pool guy was like, hey, buddy. Everything's fine, like as if it was like a stray dog that had wandered out and we were worried he was going to bite. So Gus is incredibly loyal. He's got the most beautiful personality in areas. However, he has been over the years really challenging as well. The main reason that I have found Gus really challenging is aside from just basic emotional regulation and constant crying, aside from that, it's this antagonist behavior. And what we noticed even from when he was very young is that he would walk around and it just looks like he's stirring shit, really. And he'll walk around, he might turn off the TV. He might lower the volume if someone's watching it. He might walk over and do something to upset my husband. He may poke the cat to see what will happen. And he will walk around and accidentally, on purpose, bump someone with his shoulder. If someone's asking me a question and he's irritated by it, he will start going blah, 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 which is the most irritating thing for everybody. And he'll also not let anyone ever have the last word. So if I say the sky's blue, he will say it's red and I can let it go because I'm an adult, but he will continue to say it's red even if he knows he's wrong. And that doesn't go down real well with his 2 siblings who also struggle with emotional regulation. So there's this constant stirring of the pot. When he went to prep, I was very aware of his personality. He didn't go to kindy because we went on a trip around Australia. And I knew on that trip around Australia that we had some social issues because he would go out on the jumping pillow in the caravan parks and I would hear him yell, come take me on to 2 10-year-old boys. And he would want to fight. He would want to bounce. He would want to stir up trouble. He would want to play bull rush, but then not admit he was out. And it would go around and around. And it seemed like he had constant conflict with others around him. When he did hit prep, I was hearing stories of him being hit, punched, and there was a lot of real physical violence towards him. And the teachers were so concerned. He's so beautiful. We're so sorry. We don't know why this keeps happening. And I said pretty early on, hey, does anyone else get hurt or is it just him? And sure enough, it was just him. And I highlighted to them a couple of times, hey, what did he do right before that kid did that to him? And long story short, what he was doing was he was finding the most volatile child possible. So he would find generally a neurodivergent child that might have issues with emotional regulation and impulse control. And he would rile them up secretly. And then he would eventually get hit and then he would cry. And then he would point out that that child has then hit him. And it just kept happening. And the school kept telling me it wasn't his fault. And eventually they figured out, yes, it was. So this kind of stirring of the pot and the clever behavior, I started to really get onto and the school started to see. And basically when he's bored, he, and I don't want to say can't help himself, but it seems like he can't help himself. We've moved on with medication and diagnosis. And yes, he has improved a lot, but I don't know whether the pathways in his brain are still firing off that way because he's got used to behave that way, or whether this is who he is and this is his personality. I'm unsure. One of the biggest issues for me with him is in terms of how much I have to monitor him. And this is where I find it quite draining, because if we're getting ready in the morning, he can't be left unmonitored in terms of being a bit bored. And he's also the fastest to get ready and he's the most self-sufficient. So it's an issue for me because he's always ready first and then he looks around like, what now will I do? A while ago, I used to give him an iPad because it was the only way I could walk around, do the washing, do the dishwasher. But we found it to be really disruptive in terms of our family getting him off it. And the kids would be blowing up about how fast he would be on there before they got on there and whether it was fair. There's a very strong social justice sometimes with neurodivergent children. And if it's not fair, they just can't let up. And in the end, we had to ban the iPads in the morning, which I think was a positive result. I talk more about that in the Justin Coulson episode. I'll put the links into the show notes there if you'd like to have a look. So basically, our family psychologist, who I talk about quite openly, is just so amazing. We spoke to him about it for ages because my major concern was that I was walking around after him, telling him off constantly. And I became aware on how much negative feedback do I give him a day. And I could see that he would thrive off positive reinforcement. He thrives off his relationship with me. That's his number one thing. He wants my approval. But I wasn't finding much positive to talk about. And they talk about be more positive and don't say so many negative things. But when you have a child that's only doing negative things and there's nothing positive that you can possibly find to say to them, the only positive I'd be able to say is, well done on washing your hands after going to the toilet. The most basic functions I would have to praise him for quickly before he did something else disruptive. Even just walking to a car, he would open the door before someone else teased somebody. And it would be blow up after blow up after blow up. And it is still very draining because I feel like I have an 18-month-old baby at some points, because when you have an 18-month-old, you have to keep your eye on them constantly, right? You can't let them just walk around because they could put something in their mouth. They could just do something really dangerous. And they're often a real liability to themselves, 18-month-olds. To kind of like a 2.5-year-old, 3-year-old, physically, you have to kind of keep them safe from themselves. They'll pick up a knife and just walk around if there's one, or scissors. Similar is still how I feel with my son at 7. And I hope this is resonating to you. I just want to build up what that problem looks like before going to the solution. So you might go, oh shit, I've got one of these too. So basically what I found is I've never known a kid to be more bored. And his passion in life is screens, which isn't the most positive thing possible. However, we were told by the school about how behind he was with his reading, and it was becoming quite critical that they believed he was dyslexic, which, I mean, I'm open to do more testing. So we went and did a dyslexia testing appointment at the psychologist, and it came back completely surprised to me that he was actually gifted in maths, music, and coding, and problem solving and patterns is his real area of, like, he is pretty incredible, but he's obviously got some other issues in terms of reading and spelling. And I think it's difficult to know if how behind he is as to whether he just doesn't try and hates it versus is he actually not capable to do the work. So for us, we've always known that Gus gets into trouble when he's bored. And basically what I have to do when he's here is not let him get bored. He's extremely driven on reward and extremely driven by money. He doesn't actually do anything with his money yet, but I think he just likes to have money. And so at the moment I'm working with an OT and we haven't worked out how this is going to work completely yet. But basically at the moment I'm paying him with 20 cent coins to do jobs with me in the morning. So basically these are my two options. I can go around, do my business, do the washing and do what I need to do. And then I have to break up fights. So I have to react, pull him off Billy. He will wind Billy right up. Billy's not great with emotional regulation. and Billy will kick off real quick. So those two will blow up and blow up and blow up. And we all know breaking up fights is, I think, the most draining parenting job there is. I'd prefer to wipe up, poo, vomit, look after a sick child all day than break up fights and ridiculous conversations and your two or three most loved humans in the world who seem to hate each other. I find it horrible. So basically in the mornings, I have to get up a lot earlier than everyone else, shower myself and get ready myself, because I know that when he's up, he's the quickest to get ready and he's also the most volatile. So basically I have to go around and find jobs for him. He's actually pretty good. He is the most beautiful child when he's connected to me. When I am with him and we are doing the jobs together, mate, let's do the dishwasher. Right, let's go. Oh, good job. Yep, get that one. That plate goes there. Yep, go, 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 go. Well done, Gussie. Yep, get in there, mate. Okay, washing next. Great, let's fold all these up. Who, what goes in what room? Oh, that was very quick. And it's a constant, constant, constant praise, praise, next job. Praise, praise, next job. Now, it's like a prevention for him. He doesn't stir anything and him and I have positive relationship and I talk to him positively all morning when that happens. However, it's draining, right? And also it's a reflection that I also have a partner who's there with me with the other two. And we can swap out, but we know that one of us needs to basically body double Gus. However, we also have another one that needs to be body doubled. Well, we actually have two others with a whole heap of other stuff going on. So we're spread very thin in the morning and it's draining because you have to be on the whole time. One thing that I have been doing over the last couple of years, which has worked really well for me, and this is actually, I just made this up myself, is we have what's called a restart. And the kids can have as many restarts as they want in a day. My husband and I might have to do a restart. We generally hug it out. If you've had a fight in the morning and it's a Sunday and you don't want to ruin the day by not speaking to each other, generally we hug it out and I suppose that's a restart. But the kids are the same. So Gus is really well known for a restart. He engages in the restart really often. So sometimes he can see he's done the wrong thing and he's continuing to go down that path. Once he's on that track, let's say if I go off because I have to go to the toilet in the morning and I might need more than 2 minutes, which I'm lucky to get, he may kick off that hard and that fast in that time that it's hard to get him back. And when I mean that, I mean, it's like he's in that negative pathway. He might have been told off by my husband while I'm in the toilet. I come back, he's got the shits, he's angry, and he doesn't want anything to do with anyone. He's done. And that can be really difficult to come back from. If I offer him a restart, he generally says no and yells at me. However, sometimes 2, 3, 5 minutes later, he will come back and he will say, "Mum, can I have a restart?" Or, "Mum, can I talk to you in your ear?" And generally, I will stop, talk to him, engage with him, get a bit of eye contact if I can, give him a really tight hug. And let's just be real for a moment. That can be really hard. What I've noticed is when he's kicking off really hard, my reaction is I want him away from me, because let's be honest, it's difficult when you're feeling really frustrated with someone to then soften, go down to their level, tell them that you love them with all your heart and hug them out and mean it, especially when sometimes that takes a long time. So he may pretend that he's going to do a restart and then go back. He may then lick my ear and then run off. It's that chance and chance and chance again. If I walk off to take a breath, he will follow and he will not be with my husband. It has to be me. And that can be really difficult as well, because I'm often on the forefront of everything with him. And when you've got school holidays or a 3-day weekend and that's the level of on you have to be, that's tough. And I also think we need to acknowledge that when you are a neurodivergent parent and you have a neurodivergent child, the level of downtime that you get is not comparable to a neurotypical parent in a neurotypical house. I've been to a couple of my neurotypical friends' houses and I noticed, like, you don't even notice their children. I mean, I don't know if that's normal, but I remember sitting around, I don't drink very often, but I had drinks with basically my friends and I. We went to a restaurant and they kicked us out in an hour for another booking and we got there at 5. It was like 6 o'clock. And I said, "Oh, we can't go back to my house because it was like 6 o'clock, 3 kids. I was like, we're going to have everyone on us." And I love it because no one wanted to come to my house and I didn't want to go there either. So anyway, we picked a friend's house because she liked an outdoor area, and her husband was looking after the kids, and he came down and sat and had a few drinks with us, and I love him. We have the best time. But I kept saying, where are your kids? Like, are they okay? And basically at one point he said, I think they've just put themselves to bed. They were like 7 and 6, 8 and 5. Like, they weren't old. And I went back there recently and again, didn't notice them. And she went out for dinner. Like, we went for dinner from her house. We went and had a couple of drinks at her house. We left and she just went, see ya. And then I don't even know if they hugged. Like, my kids are across the driveway screaming, begging, telling me they're going to die if I don't come back soon. And she just left. So I think we need to be realistic that neurodivergent parenting is a lot harder with the amount of emotional regulation. And often our kids need us to emotionally regulate with them, which is called co-regulating, for a lot longer. So they do have that feeling of when mum's not there, what will happen? And they are 30% delayed. So what I'm saying is engaging in a restart can be a really positive thing to do. And I've noticed that I have to connect in with my kids, even if I don't feel like it. And it does take a lot of energy because I often feel like I'm pushing all of my own feelings down and all of my needs to put my children's needs first. Like, I need a minute too, mate. Like, but I know that if I reject him in that moment, and even though it's not a rejection, it's me taking a breath, he sees it as a rejection. And if I try and pass him to my husband to give myself a moment, it doesn't work. So for me, and this is a non-expert view, this is a ADHD mum, I'm not a parenting expert. For me, I have to tap in, and I actually, this sounds horrible, right? But I'm just sharing what I do. I had this nightmare once, and it was like the Walking Dead were coming. I don't know if anyone's seen that. And everyone got separated and the world was ending. And I couldn't find my husband or my 3 children. And everyone was walking around like in The Walking Dead, like chaotic, like running and screaming and trying to get places, but there was nowhere safe. And there were so many people. And I thought, how will I ever find my children? And when something's so vivid, I actually feel emotional now. It was such a vivid dream. And my first thought pattern was, this was about a year ago, and Billy was only 4. And my first thought pattern was, Billy has the least coping resources possible. So my thought pattern was, find Billy in this dream, find Billy, find Billy. I couldn't find him. And as I gave up and I was just crying and crying, I came across Gus, and he looked at me. He was actually like under, like in a shopping center, you look over the side and there's like an elevator or an escalator with stairs coming up. He was coming up the stairs and it was so packed. I thought, I don't think I'm going to be able to get to him. I started screaming and putting my hands out to him, and he looked at me with this face of just, help me. I was just so, the dream was so vivid. And I just, as a mum, you just push through people. I probably flattened people to get to the top of this escalator. I grabbed him and hugged him, and he cried and cried, and so did I in this dream. And I actually have to tap into that dream when I'm to that point with him, so I don't need that moment, or I can get that moment in another 5 minutes so I can hang on longer. And I try to get to myself to a point emotionally where I can tap into just the unconditional love that I have for him, even though he's making a mistake and he's not making a good choice. I love him no matter what, and that's what I tap into. So I give him a hug, I look him in the eye, and I give him another chance when I don't want to. And it's tough, hey. And it's usually in that final one, when I'm broken and he can see me, that he will stop, soften, I will soften, and he will take a moment, he will do a restart, a proper one. And once he's on a proper restart, I take a breath and I go out and I get my announcement face on, because I'm actually a very soft, or you can probably tell from this podcast, my husband's definitely more of the authoritarian figure. I'm definitely the softer one. And I will get my announcement voice on, and people kind of, the kids kind of know what that is now. And Gus is holding my hand, and I say to the kids, Gussie has something to say. And Gus usually said something like, I'm really sorry for teasing you all morning, Billy. I'm really sorry. I didn't make a very good choice, and I would like a restart. And I help him with that. It can also be as well modeling the I'm sorry. I'm really all about modeling taking responsibility. If I have which I'm not perfect either, right? If I have in that half an hour that I've missed the window to get him on the right track and I have lost my temper with him or I've done something, I will always apologize as well. And I have made my husband do that too. And my hubby isn't naturally that person. And I've really had to, and to be fair to him, he's the most open man in terms of if I explain to him the why and the science and the brain, he will actually do it. But if I just say to him, you need to apologize to a child, he doesn't get it, but he will do it. And because I said to him, if our kids never see you apologize or me, and we never take responsibility for anything that we do wrong, how can we expect them to? So we will apologize too if there's something that we've done wrong. If one of the other kids has called him a name or something, they would generally apologize and we would do a restart. And generally everyone's used to it now. We all take a breath. If it's been a horrific, like, you know how it doesn't happen all the time, but maybe it's every couple of months, like it's been a really, really hard one, I will generally turn on YouTube and I'll put on a song, and I don't ask anybody because we're not having conflict. I will put on a song that I know that everybody enjoys and we will dance. And we will just dance it out for 3 minutes. And even when I'm not feeling it and I don't want to dance and I'm actually feeling really shitty, I will do it. And I will do it in the stupidest, most hilarious way. I will on purpose. I mean, I'm an awful dancer. It's not very hard, but I will dance like a crazy, stupid woman on purpose. And I will sing and I will, that's why I pick the music, if I'm honest, because I need to lead by example. And if I need to, I'll put that YouTube on. And we will dance. And it's just a 3 minute dance. It's a dance party. Depending on the mood and what's going on, I might extend the dance party. If, let's say, it's Saturday and we're not doing anything, there's nowhere to go. And I'll say, right, after this song, each of you can pick one song and that's it. The TV's off if we've got to go somewhere or whatever it is. But highly structuring whose turn it is always works for me. It is definitely not a good idea after I finish my dance song to then go and then one of the other kids goes, can I have this song? And I just put it on. And someone goes, well, I wanted that song. I have to create the structure up front every time. We get in the car, it's a 12-minute drive. Okay, there's enough time for three songs. One of you pick each. Or if I've got the shits and I don't want anyone to pick a song, I'll go, mummy's the DJ today. Or I'll go on Spotify and just do the DJ one and go, the DJ's on. Sorry, we're not getting any song requests today. For me, coping with antagonist children, and Gus is by far, I think he is probably naturally a shit stirrer. However, you've got to look at the genetics that he's come from too. So my husband is a shit stirrer. He stirs me all the time. My husband loves to tease. Like even if I'm in a bit of a bad mood, I'm in the morning and I'm walking around in a circle trying to figure out where a lunchbox is. And he'll go, you don't know what you're doing, do you? And he'll always do his little side comments. And actually, to be honest, humor is probably one of the strongest parts to our relationship and the beautiful friendship. I'm so incredibly lucky to have my husband. However, life is a roller coaster and we've done an absolute bucket load of work on our relationship and on our marriage. So I don't take that lightly. And I understand there's single mums out there. But if you have two adults in your relationship, to get both people on board with what you're doing is the most important thing. And for my husband, he needs to understand the why. And he's a bit more old school. He has been, as a lot of the people in our generation have, that we've been smacked, we've been put in time out, we've had a lot of discipline that we probably wouldn't necessarily do the same way. And if we look at the mental health in our generation, I don't think it's great either. So when we say, I was treated like this and it was great for me, really, because it seems like there's a lot of mental health across the country. So I think we could probably try to do something different. Regardless of how challenging our children are, I always tap back into how much I love them. And I always say the same three things to them before they go to sleep at night or before they go anywhere or I go anywhere. I have a few things that I say as a ritual. And I would imagine they're going to be 20 years old, I'll still be doing it. And those three things are, I love you with all my heart. I love you no matter what. And if I had one boy in the world, who would I pick? And he would say, me. Or sometimes Gus will say his friend, Sam. And I'll be like, Okay, yes, it was Sam. What if you were the naughtiest boy in the world? Would I still love you? And he says, yes. And I always say, I love you no matter what. It doesn't matter what choice you make. I will always be here for you. You can always call me. And I give him a little speech on how much I love them. And it doesn't matter what they do. I will always be there for them. And I think when you tap in really hard to that connection, and I understand neurodivergent children can be difficult and every child is different. And this doesn't work on every child. But when I tap in really hard on the connection with my children, they do better. And when I say better, I mean, we are happier. We're more likely to have a good afternoon. It's kind of like engaging team members. If you're a manager at work, you need to engage every team member in your team to get the job done. And that includes your partner as well. So when you have, I call it Team McFadden, which is probably a bit, maybe it's a bit silly, but I always talk about Team McFadden and who are the most important people? Us, Team McFadden. And if we're out in a playground and someone's teasing one of our brothers or sisters, are we more concerned about what our friend is doing or impressing somebody? Or are we concerned about how our brother and sister is feeling? And I think the connection piece for me is what I use most for my antagonist. And that's one of the things that I think is the most important. If you have an antagonist, make sure you drink lots of coffee, have lots of energy, and give them lots of jobs. And preparation is key. Have 5 or 6 things that you know that they can help with and train them. Often they've got a lot of energy. So I train my son to empty the dishwasher, do the washing, separate all the clothes onto the kids' beds, put them in the drawers, unpack the lunches. And as I said, I pay him 20 cents. Sometimes he needs the dopamine hit of the coin. And I will do that for him if I need to. And continuing to give that positive feedback, have that positive reflection and give him that leadership opportunity really works for me. But I wish you well with your antagonist child. And I hope that this was helpful.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.